Our colleague Scott Simon remembers the moment that he and his wife decided to adopt. Scott and Caroline Simon traveled twice to China to bring back children. In his new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, the Saturday host of NPR's Weekend Edition says they decided to adopt after struggling to conceive.
We'd both been around the world. We'd both seen different places. We'd both been in places where there are a lot of children who'd been abandoned, and we just looked at each other and said, why are we doing this? There are children in the world now who need our love, and we sure need them.
This really is an emotional choice that you make. If you made a rational, if you had a rational thought process about it, if you tried to consider it as a business decision, you wouldn't really do it. It's something that you do because you want to do it.
It is an emotional choice. And for some people, adoption is just something that will that they think will never work with them. And so they decide not to do it. All of that being said, I would like to open that door for people. It is difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to adopt a child in this country, whether it's whether you adopt internationally, as my wife and I did, whether you adopt domestically, may I say, as your family did, as your parents did.
My parents did, yes.
And because of that, for a lot of people, the assisted fertility industry is just an obvious alternative to that. That being said, look, the instinct to adopt, to take children into our lives is, I think, practically as old as childbirth.
How much did you think about the fact in advance that the baby you were going to adopt from China was going to be a Chinese baby?
You know, we knew it, but I can't say we thought about it much. And we certainly didn't think about it much. We went to China to get both of our little girls. We want to travel back to China every few years so they can get a chance to see the country up close as they grow up. But all of that being said, it's a feature of their personality. I think, not the defining trait of our relationship.
You write that somebody asked your wife, do you feel guilty for taking your daughters away from their native culture?
Yeah. A very learned woman who we like a lot, who's a friend of the family. And my wife just answered, no, not really. I think I would have had a tougher time holding my tongue. And that's because when we talk about ethnicity, we say Chinese. To someone who's Chinese, that's not necessarily their ethnicity. There are almost 100 ethnicities that are living in China. So in a sense, we don't really know their ethnicity. So we shouldn't get, I think, too preoccupied with it. One of my favorite vignettes that I have in the book is about Martin Simon, who was the son of the late Paul Simon, senator from Illinois, no relation to me, alas, and Gene Simon, who grew up with, it appeared on his birth certificate that he was Native American. And he grew up, his father was an influential member of the Senate Subcommittee on Native American Affairs.
Deliberately so, right?
Because
deliberately
he's like,
oh, I've
so.
Got a, yeah.
And people, his high school friends would look at him and say, you know, Martin, he's part Cherokee. And people would say, yeah, you can tell when you look at him. And you might see where this story is going. Years later, he's 28 years old. He meets his birth mother, who's only 15 years older than him. They're talking and reaching out to each other and enjoying getting to know each other. But as he said to me, she looked just about as Native American as Diana, Princess of Wales. And he finally said to her, how are we Indian? And she said, Indian? He said, yes, in my birth certificate it says Native American. And she said, oh, they asked me what we were, and I said, we're all American. And as he said, you know, I spent all that time going to powwows. I mean, he felt Native American. He didn't feel Scandinavian, which turns out to be his ethnic heritage. But I think the point of that, firstly, is the power of suggestion. Mm-hmm. He said all of those years, nobody ever looked at him and said, come on, now, you're not American Indian. And I think it's also an instruction to us to not invest too much of our identity in ethnicity.
Your kids must be getting to that age, if they haven't practically always been in it, when they start asking you awkward questions about everything. What are some of the hardest questions you've heard from your kids?
The hardest question I've heard is from our 7-year-old daughter, Elise, who says, why did my mother give me up? And that's a rough one.
I'm sorry, you know, I get this way when I talk about my children. It's okay.
That's a rough one because she's old enough to understand that she was given up by a woman who, when we tell her your mother loved you and she wanted to take care of you for the rest of your life and she wanted to be a mother to you, but she just couldn't. Yet it's hard, I think, for a seven-year-old to understand. How do you explain China's one-child policy? How do you explain
the bias toward that one child being a boy rather
exactly.
than a girl?
Yeah. How do you really explain that? She also, you know, children tend not to be metaphorical the way we are. They're literal. So she asks, because we've told her the story that we know, that she was left in front of a light bulb factory, and she says, she asks, "Was I cold?"
Oh.
And. We say, no, you weren't. Your mother wrapped you up before she put you there on the sidewalk, pretty confident that you'd be discovered by someone who would help you. So she wrapped you up. But, you know, I think to a degree I really respect in both of our youngsters, and it's audible now with Elise, they're comfortable with being adopted. There is no way that we're going to be able to spare them the sting and the hurt of feeling that at some point there was someone who gave them up. No matter how many times we explained your mother loved you, no matter how many times we explained that we're grateful for the courage your mother had to even bear you in China, I don't think we can spare her the hurt. But, you know, we learn from hurts in life, don't we? You know, we put something over them and we keep on going. And I think our two daughters are going to be very strong, in part because of that. I don't think they're going to be broken by that.
Scott Simon's latest book is called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
This weekend marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast and New Orleans. Many books have been written about the aftermath. Essayist Ralph Eubanks has been reading a new one called Beyond Katrina.
On one of her trips back to the Mississippi Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina, poet Natasha Trethewey noticed a sign in front of a Baptist church emblazoned with this command, "Believe the report of the Lord, face the things that confront you." Trethewey takes those words to heart. Like the gifted memoirist she proves to be in the pages of Beyond Katrina, a meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, she indeed faces and confronts demons from her past and the present. The result is a book as moving and compelling as Trethewey's poetry. When we begin to imagine a future in which the places of our past no longer exist, we see ruin. The ruin and destruction move beyond the eroding beaches and ancient uprooted live oak trees that line the Mississippi Gulf Coast. What she explores with emotional depth and sensitivity is the psychic toll Katrina has taken on her family and the community they live in. This fall will bring a number of books to a growing body of literature on this disaster. What makes Beyond Katrina stand out in the crowded landscape of post-Katrina literature is the raw, personal nature of the story Trethewey tells, as well as the poetic language she uses to tell the tale. She moves the reader beyond the uplifting narrative of rebuilding, represented by each new glitzy casino along the shores of the Mississippi Gulf. Instead, she tells a story beyond the gambling palaces and moves a few miles from the Gulf beaches, up Highway 49, into African-American and working-class North Gulfport. North Gulfport is where Trethewey spent her summers with her grandmother as a girl, and where her brother Joe came to live after his father, Trethewey's stepfather, murdered their mother. Although her grandmother must have seen her daughter's murderer when she looked at Joe, the family somehow found a way to look beyond that personal tragedy. Perhaps to counter this perception, Joe seems to assume the persona of her grandmother's beloved brother, Son Dixon, a legendary nightclub owner and African-American entrepreneur, and immerses himself in his Uncle Son's business of owning and renovating shotgun houses in North Gulfport. Before Katrina, Joe's life and business is on track. After Katrina, forces of nature and circumstance lead to his imprisonment. To tell the story of Joe's attempt to rebuild his life and the simple tragic act that leads to his incarceration, she mixes prose, poetry, personal letters, and what few childhood photographs survive the storm. Beyond Katrina is just what the subtitle says it is, a meditation. But within this book's quiet thoughts lies a powerful story of things long gone that will never come back.
Beyond Katrina will be published next week. Ralph Eubanks is the author of Ever is a Long Time, A Journey into Mississippi's Dark Past. He's also director of publishing at the Library of Congress.
We could mention all the awards that David Mitchell has won for his novels, and might. For the moment, let's leave it at this. He is the one contemporary novelist who's mentioned in the same breath as Nabokov and Tolstoy. He's considered a virtuoso of complex plot and intricate language, wry humor, dense history, and indelible characters. David Mitchell's latest book is a historical novel set in Japan in 1799, when a few Dutch traders are allowed to briefly and lightly attach themselves onto isolated feudal Japanese society. His book is The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. David Mitchell joins us. He's on tour now, and he's out at member station KQED in San Francisco. Mr. Mitchell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, Scott, and thanks for that lovely introduction as well. I recorded it and will play it back to myself on bad days, so thank you for that.
So you were, teaching in Nagasaki in 1994 when the spirit of this book first entered your mind?
Yes, I was backpacking in the west of Japan. As usual, I had no money and I was looking for a cheap lunch in Chinatown, but I couldn't read the streetcar signs. So quite by chance, stumbled across what looked like a couple of elegant, beautiful white warehouses from a much earlier historical period than the rest of the city. That was Dejima Museum. And I never did get the lunch that day, but I filled a notebook with information about this place I'd never heard of and resolved one day to write about it.
And the Dejima was where the Dutch East India Company was permitted to briefly and lightly attach themselves to Japan.
That's correct, yes. And it was a trading post on a very small artificial island, about a third of an acre, half an acre maybe, year-round, probably 10, 12... at most 15 Europeans, mostly but not exclusively Dutch, were obliged to live on the island. They weren't allowed off, so this wasn't one of those trading posts that the British established in India or the Dutch in Java, which slowly turned into a full-blown colony. The Japanese remained very much in control, and the only three types of people allowed on were merchants and translators and apparently very, very expensive prostitutes, proving that then as now perhaps the Japanese recognize a captive market when they see one.
And Jacob de Zoet is, if you please, a clerk, an accountant who arrives there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dutch are confined and he discovers that not everybody is as honest as he is.
No, he got the job on the coattails of a patron, a man called Vorstenbosch, who in turn was appointed this very lucrative position on the understanding that he would take a broom to the place and sweep out the corruption, the sort of goings-on that would make Enron blush. Jacob soon discovers that even his patron, Vorstenbosch, has his own agenda. Everyone has their own agenda, really. And he finds himself an honest man in a nest of vipers.
We don't want to give away too much of an intricate plot, but Jacob de Zoet falls in love with a midwife, Orito. Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's perfect.
But she is, gotten to a nunnery to settle her father's debts.
Yes, 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 that's the case. And it's not just an ordinary nunnery either. It's rather darker than that. How dark, I think I might not say here, though.
It is a nunnery, but not in the Audrey Hepburn movie sense.
Not at all, no. More in the Black Narcissus sense, maybe.
One of the pleasures of the historical novel, and especially your version of the historical novel, is the lush recreation of the details of what it was to be alive in 1799. How do you acquire that level of detail?
I think of the research in terms of hard research and soft research. The hard research is where you go through archives and find, in this case, the journals that the chief residents of the Dutch East India Company kept. It's also persuading history lecturers, in this case again at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, to spend a couple of hours answering my rather undergraduate level questions. And then there's soft research, which really goes on until the day you finish the manuscript. Say I'm writing a scene where some backstory is being delivered in the frame of my character having a shave. Immediately you hit this question: did they have shaving foam in those days? If so, was it affordable to a middle-ranking clerk? Or if you're writing a scene at night, how's the room lit? Is it going to be pig tallow candles or sperm whale oil lanterns, which give off nice bright light, but it's very expensive? You have to know all of that. And sometimes you can't finish a sentence without spending half a morning going away and finding it out. And then, of course, you do have to hide it. Otherwise, you get ridiculous sentences where the servant walks in and says, "Is it going to be pig tallow candles, my lord, or would you prefer the sperm whale oil lantern?" Which, of course, makes you laugh and kills fiction. And we haven't even begun to discuss language. To what degree do you date the language? If you get it absolutely right, if you trawl through 18th century novels and letters and write it all down and reproduce it perfectly, it's almost comic pastiche. But then if you ignore the fact we're in the past and you have an 18th century character flouncing into the room like a character from Scrubs or Friends saying, "You know, that's just so not what I meant," then the bubble of the illusions pricked and it's gone and you're left with a horrible mess.
So you're writing in English about people speaking in Dutch and Japanese, a novel that must be read and understood in the 21st century, understood in the 21st century that is set in the 18th.
Just so. It's quite a tall order. Yes, it was tough. It took me 4 years and it almost finished me off before I finished it off.
We sort of agreed not to mention all the awards you've had. Let's just say you've been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, the Granta Best Young Novelist, one of Time's most influential people.
How my wife laughed when she heard that. She said, "You're not even the fourth most influential person in the house. You're number five after the washing machine." It's true.
Of course, he's never influential in his own family.
Oh, well, that's nice to know it's true in other men's households as well. Of course, it's very gratifying, and any writer sort of is happy to hear that other people are responding positively to his or her writing. But it also has to not matter. It also has to not be why you meet people on this book tour. And they explain why their writings made a connection with their lives sometimes. And truly, that's worth more than any booker.
Well, Mr. Mitchell, real pleasure. Good luck.
Thank you very much indeed, Scott. It's been great speaking with you.
David Mitchell. His new novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet.
We're going to hear now from a dramatist who's turned her attention to the basics, the ABCs. Chiara Alegria Hudes has written about the lingering wounds of war in her play Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue. She also wrote the book for the hit Broadway musical In the Heights. That's the tale of one block in New York, peopled with immigrants from Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, and set to the rhythms and rhymes of Latin music and hip-hop. Now, Chiara Hudes is out with her first tale for kids. It's called Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC, located in the city of her childhood.
I decided to set this book in North Philadelphia, where many of my family live, including my grandma and many young cousins. And the concept was that one girl who's from North Philadelphia, where a lot of Latinos live, is giving a tour, a neighborhood tour, to her best friend who's from Chinatown, and he's come to visit her for the day.
And it's from the point of view of that little girl who is, as you say, introducing her friend to her neighborhood. Let's just start with A.
Okay. So let's see. Here we start with A is for abuela and abandoned car.
And abuela is a grandmother.
That's right. You know, I think one of the defining features for me growing up in my neighborhood was an older generation from Puerto Rico who had an open-door policy in what many considered from the outside to be a dangerous neighborhood. But in fact, this open-door policy is what kept people safe. It was how children were supervised playing outside. And it's how, you know, a hungry neighbor could be fed after work if they didn't have time to go home and cook, if they didn't have money to go and get something from, you know, the corner restaurant.
Now, right off in the A's, there's an abandoned car. It's not too tough, but real clearly this is not an affluent neighborhood.
That's right. My inspiration for writing this book wasn't to talk about how gritty and real the neighborhood was. It was more about the joy of observing. So that we're not just watching TV all the time, we're not just looking at our little tiny screens all the time, but look and see what's around you, observe what's around you. So in this case, that includes, you know, an abuela hugging the grandkids, and it does include an abandoned car, you know, and that has some downsides to it, no doubt, but there's interest and stories in all of those things.
Well, even though when you are illustrating with your words parts of the neighborhood that might not be considered beautiful. The language itself is spare and really quite lovely. Read us the bees.
B is for the bottles that are smashed like falling stars. Broken bottles of black cherry soda bought at Barrio Bodegas. C is for the Chino Latino corner store we call Ortegas.
That's a lovely way of seeing it. Could very well be a child's way of seeing smash bottles on the street glinting. And the illustration there, multicolored.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember I collect marbles. I have collected marbles since I was a kid, and I still collect them, and now my daughter loves them. And I've always just found, you know, different colored glass to be kind of fanciful and playful. And so I remember one of the features of a lot of the sidewalks in Philadelphia is that the broken glass has actually become imprinted into the cement. So the sidewalk can actually take on a mosaic quality. It's a totally chaotic mosaic. But, you know, these are the things I would notice when I was just kind of walking from Abuela's house to the corner store to get her milk or something like that. And I realized today, you know, this is a little nostalgic because everyone has plastic bottles today. So the broken glass might not be as common now as it was when I was a kid.
Why don't you read some more for us? Pick up anywhere you'd like.
I'll start with the ice cream truck because that is where any youthful story should actually start. But A is not for ice cream, so I'll pick up at the letter I. I is for the ice cream truck in infinite flavors so sweet. J is for los jíbaros, jamming in the jungle of concrete. K is for the kitchen window where kidney beans boil and pork chops pop. L is for the living room ledges and little old ladies who guard the block. M is for los muralistas, making murals of island vistas, waterfalls that hide brick walls, rainforests full of tropical trees. N is for the noisy neighbors who sit on the stoop and catch the breeze.
How did you settle on the words to represent the letters of the alphabet? Because some are English and some are Spanish, like Q, for instance.
Well, Q is for quemar, which is to burn a house to the ground beneath, making a block full of row homes look like a smile that's missing its two front teeth. Q is like X. It's one of those letters that's, you know, notoriously difficult in alphabet books, and, you know, it ends up being queen. You know, there's a handful of three things that it'll end up being, but in Spanish, it's a much more frequently used letter, and it's one of the darker passages in the book, but you know, the thing about growing up in North Philly and, you know, there a house would burn down or a house would kind of fall apart and be dilapidated. And then I had an aunt who led a movement to turn abandoned lots into public gardens. And we get to that part later in the book. So even points that might be a little bit darker in the book end up having a flip side, like a growth, a life to them.
There are a couple of poignant passages here. R is very touching, especially from a child's eye view.
R is about growing up in a language and in a geography that's very different from the one where your parents grew up. You know, I grew up in cement and brick and, you know, my parents grew up in the countryside in Puerto Rico, speaking Spanish. And that's all captured in R, and I'll read R right now. R for mommy's favorite word. She always says, remember. Remember that, remember when, remember all the things now gone. Remember red comb rooster singing kikiriki to the dawn. Remember Rincon Beach in Puerto Rico, how the sun would set.
And you would hear that from your own mother or your aunties or something like that?
They always said remember. And in fact, before I made the decision to become a writer, my grandmother was getting along in years and her health was suffering. And my mom said to me, you know, you're the one who's gone to college. You're the one who can write these stories down. So ask her the stories and write them down or they'll be gone.
Playwright Kiara Alegria Hudis has written the children's book Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.